Okay, so we'll just use this as a springboard. I'll just keep going through reviewing these unless you have a question. So then just let me know if you have a question about any of them. So the first questions 1 through 6 refer to general statistical knowledge. And the first question says, suppose that two characteristics, A and B, are mutually exclusive. So by that, we know that means they cannot occur at the same time. So if we go through each of these in turn, the first one says the probability of A or B, that's the union, equals zero. This is not what we're looking for. This is not classifying mutually exclusive. This next one is the conditional probability of A versus B equals the probability of A equals the probability A versus not B. And that would actually be an answer to a question about if A and B were independent. So that doesn't refer to mutually exclusive. The probability that A and B occurring together is one is not mutually exclusive, whereas the answer we were looking for was D, the probability of A and B, their joint probability equals zero. So that ties in completely into mutually exclusive. And then we see here the last one, the joint probability equals the product of the separate probabilities. This also would have been true for independence, but not for mutually exclusive. Okay? So there were a lot of answers to these questions that would have been true if the question had been asking about independence. But the question is asking about mutually exclusive. And you'll notice that it's bolded. So when they are bolded, that's usually an attempt to say, pay attention to this particular thing. Okay. So the next question says, suppose that a study in a sample of size 50 is performed, so N equals 50. The investigators report the standard error of the sample mean blood pressure. So the standard error of the sample mean blood pressure is the same as the standard deviation of the sample mean blood pressure. It's the variability in sample means under this theoretical sampling distribution over all possible samples of size N. And it's reflecting the population standard deviation sigma, as well as the sample size. So the question is asking, what does that standard error of the mean reflect? This describes A, the variability in blood pressure in the underlying population from which the sample was drawn. This is false because the answer to this would have been sigma. 2, the variability in blood pressure in the sample of 50 individuals, that's not reflecting the standard error of the mean because that answer would have been S, the sample standard deviation. The variability in sample mean blood pressures over all possible samples of different sample sizes, that's nothing we've ever done. It's not the definition of a sampling distribution. Sampling distribution is using all possible sample sizes of the same size. So if you think of this, this was the X bars that come from all possible samples of size N equals 50, in this case, from the underlying population. So we're left with two more. The variability in sample mean blood pressures, meaning the X bars, over all possible samples of size root N or of size 50. And so the answer to this is E. It's the variability in the X bars over all possible samples of size 50. I know a lot of you wanted to say root 50, but the square root of 50 is what is in the denominator of that standard error calculation. The sample size itself is not the square root of 50. The sample size is 50. So the underlying sampling distribution of the X bars is over all possible samples of size 50. Question?
I guess it's D, but why, going back to A and B,
sure.
Why are we treating this as sigma X bar, and why don't we call it S bar?
Okay, so let's go back to the question was, what about A and B, and what are they reflecting? So the question stub is talking about the standard error of the sample mean. And so right away, we should say standard error means the same thing as standard deviation of a sample statistic. And in this case, the sample statistic is X bar. So we would write that as sigma X bar equals sigma over the square root of n. We don't typically know sigma from the population. So then we estimate this. So I'll put a caret or a hat over this. We'd estimate sigma using the sample standard deviation, s, over the square root of n. But what the question was referring to is, what does that standard error of the mean, meaning the sigma of x bar, refer to? And so A is referring to just population standard deviation, which is sigma. B is referring to sample standard deviation, which is S. But the standard error of the mean, keyword here, sample mean. Sample mean means X bar, the statistic X bar. We're talking about the variability in the values of X bar. So, and you're right, we estimate it often by S, but that whole quantity, even estimated, is S over the square root of N, which estimates the variability. So what I'm pointing out here right now is the sampling distribution of the X bars, that there's a spread in the values that those possible sample means can take. Okay, I'll move on unless we have another question. So I think the hang-up was that we use the square root of 50 in calculating the standard error, but the standard error is reflecting variability in the X bars that are computed from samples of size 50. Yes? No nods, positive or negative? Yeah. Question? Well, so the term that we've been using for standard error is that standard error reflects variability in the values a statistic might take in a theoretical sampling distribution. So that's the time we use standard error of X bar, standard error of X1 bar minus X2 bar. It's the same as saying, when we use the word standard error, it's the same as saying standard deviation of the sample mean in the sampling distribution from which that statistic was generated. We reserve that term standard error to refer to variability in values, theoretical values that a statistic can take. So if one was thinking the standard, see that whole word there, the standard error of the sample mean, is reflecting what I wrote before, sigma X bar. What's the spread? What's the variability in the values of the X bars? The wording would have had to have been very different for A or B to be the answer. It could have said, the reporters report the standard deviation in the sample. How's that sound? The investigators report the standard deviation in the sample. If that was the question, then the answer to this describes would have been B, the variability in blood pressure in the sample of 50 individuals. If it had said the investigators report the were told that it was given to them that the population standard deviation was known to be this measure, then that would have been the variability in blood pressures in the underlying population because they were told what sigma was. Okay, one more. No, so this doesn't have anything to do with the bootstrap. So the bootstrap is a computational method for approximating this, but we've talked about these being underlying theoretical distributions that come from both either an assumption that the underlying population distribution is normal, or the other is if the sample size is large enough, the central limit theorem holds. But this is not the bootstrap interval. This is the theoretical sampling distribution. One more.
So the standard error of the sample mean is given by the equation standard deviation over the square root of the population?
That's right. Over the square root of the sample size, not the population size.
So how is that not a description for... So I chose the one with the square root.
Right. Right. So I'll try to repeat this again. So the way we calculate the estimate of the variability of the X bars, and so sigma X bar represents how much spread there is around the center of that distribution of the X bars, it's computed by taking sigma over the square root of n. But the question is, where did these sample means, where are they calculated from? They're calculated from individual samples of size 50. They're not calculated based on samples of size 7 point something. They're coming from samples of size 50. So I could do a sample of size 50 and calculate one X bar. You could do another independent sample. We could have done all possible samples. They'd all be based on samples of size 50, not of the square root of 50. It's just the computation of that value is saying the spread in the X bars depends on two things. It depends on how much spread there is in the population, which is sigma, and it depends on the sample size. So if the sample size had been increased to 100, then we would have had samples, all possible samples of size 100, but there'd be much less spread in the possible values of the X bar because that computation of the standard error would have been divided by the square root of 100. So I'm happy to talk about this with, you know, others at the end too. We can come back to that, but I think we should probably move on to question number three. So question, or I could pause one more second on number two and say, is there anybody here who actually answered it wrong and now understands why it was wrong? Okay. And so if you answered that it was the square root of 50 and now you understand that it's 50, would you like to explain to everyone or have me translate for you why you now understand that it should be across all possible samples of size 50 instead of the square root of 50? Any tips that anybody wants to say?
Yeah. I understand size 50, but I thought that you wrote it like the interpreting the answer in words. So then if you look at it that way, you end up between the square root of 50. It sounds like
Well, I'll just answer one more time because I want to make sure that you get this. And the key is that this answer, I know that, you know, sometimes one can read things that aren't there, but this, what is here is it says, what does the standard error, which we know is given by sigma over the square root of n, what does it describe? And it describes the variability in the X bars that we would have gotten if we had taken all possible samples of size 50, calculated the sample means, the X bars from them, plotted them in a histogram, and we would have seen that standard error is describing how much spread there is in the sample means that came from these samples of size 50. So I'm happy to talk about it later, but let's go on to question three. So which of the following is not a feature of normal distributions? So the bolded word here is not. So not, meaning look for the one that's not right. So they characterize the possible values and their relative probabilities for continuous random variables. Is the normal for continuous random variables? So this is true, so that's not going to be our false answer. They are symmetric distributions. They're beautiful symmetric distributions. That's true. The variance is equal to the proportion responding positively times 1 minus that proportion. So this is looking very binomial-ish, right? This P's and Q's are for dichotomous variables. So this is actually not a characteristic of the normal distribution. So this would be false. But then let's go on to the other ones. They are fully characterized by just two parameters, mean mu and the variance sigma squared. That's true. All normal distributions have two parameters. And then E, any normal variable can be reproduced as the mean of its distribution plus or minus standard deviation times the times the number of standard deviation it lies above or below. So we can talk about mu plus or minus 1.5 standard deviations plus or minus 2 standard deviations. So this is also true. So the answer that was false, that's not a feature of the normal distribution, is the one that says the variance is equal to P times Q. So now we're on to number 4. So 4 says the prevalence rate of tuberculosis in the United States is 3.2 cases per 1,000 individuals in 2012. So I see the word rate. I see rate. So I'm going to say rate is 3.2 cases per 100,000 individuals in this particular year. So assuming this rate, the question is, what's the probability of observing one or more cases in a two-year period, and it happens to say 2014 to 2015, but the key is that this has a two-year period, whereas what we have was the rate in a one-year period, and so we're going to call that mu, the rate, which is cases per one-year period. The time period, we're now told, is 2 years, but we're also told that it has a town with 25,000 individuals. So it's going to be 2 years times 25,000 individuals. So this is looking pretty much like a Poisson distribution problem, in which we have a rate, we have a time period, so we need to figure out lambda. So the question is, what is lambda if we take the rate times the time period? So let's keep the units here. I'm sorry for this pop-up, but there's nothing I can do. So the rate is 3.2 cases per 100,000 individuals or people. We have, and that is in a one-year period. Our time period here is 2 years. And this was per individuals per year. And our time period is 2 years, but how many individuals are in that town? 25,000 individuals. So we have to multiply by 25,000. You with me? So that we have cases per individuals. Maybe you would like it better this way. How about if I said it's 100,000 person in 1 year, because we have people per year, so we'll have person years, whereas now our time period will be 2 years times 200 times 25,000 persons, which is the same as saying 50 person years. So I think that I can get rid of years, I can get rid of persons, and if I go through the calculation, I'm left with an expected number of cases. So lambda should equal 3.2 times 2 times 25,000 divided by 100,000. And so it looks to me like we can do this in our head as 3.2 times 2. 25,000 divided by 100,000 will just reduce to 1/4. And so this to me looks like it's about 0.8 times 2, which is 1.6. So that would be our lambda. Sound good? So we had to take into account the time period, the number of individuals, to get an expected number of 1.6 cases. So now we'll go back and say, using the Poisson distribution, what's the probability that X is greater than or equal to 1? Well, that's the same as 1 minus the probability that X equals 0. And this is where I would go back and remember that we do have a formula sheet. And if we went back and looked at the formula sheet, we'd see the Poisson formula is just e to the negative lambda, lambda raised to the x power all over divided by x factorial. But I didn't need to memorize that because it's on the formula sheet. So don't forget to look at the formula sheet when you study or when you take the exam. So here, what's x? We're looking at this as 1 minus the probability that x equals 0. So we can write that as e to the negative lambda, e to the negative 1.6, times 1.6 raised to the 0 power divided by 0 factorial. And so a lot of these things reduce to 1. So what are we left with? 1 minus e to the negative 1.6. And does that look like a number that's up here? Looks like B, 1 minus e to the negative 1.6. Questions? Okay, go on. To number 5. So number 5 is about the bootstrap. Number 5 says, construction of a 95% bootstrap interval based on the difference between two sample means, x1 bar minus x2 bar, requires what? So let's just review really quickly what a bootstrap interval is. A bootstrap is a computational method where it takes a sample, or in this case it would have sample 1 and sample 2, and it pretends that that's the original sample. And with sampling with replacement, so with replacement means if I'm selected, I can be selected again in that particular sample. So it computationally is just doing these samples over and over and over again, maybe 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 times. So it's sampling with replacement. That's a key attribute of a bootstrap. So if we look at the answers, sampling with replacement of repeated samples of the same sizes from the original two samples, that is true. And that's looking like that will be a good contender for this answer. But let's say why the other ones are not. Sampling without replacement of repeated samples of different large sample sizes from the original two. So what's wrong with that statement? Two things. Without is wrong, and different large samples is wrong. This is false. The assumption that the sample sizes are large and the central limit theorem holds, bootstrap has no assumptions. It's computational. No assumptions with bootstraps. The assumption that sampling is based on sampling without replacement from underlying normal distributions for the two populations, what's wrong with that? So the assumption, so we don't assume underlying normal distributions, that's false. Without replacement would be false, so it's just multiply wrong. And lastly, the assumption that the variances are equal in the underlying distributions for the two populations. Bootstrap makes no assumptions about distribution or the parameters. So our only possible answer is A, sampling with replacement of repeated samples of the same sizes from the original two samples. Okay, moving on to number 6. Number 6 says, match these terms. Match these terms. This is a game. This is a game. Match these terms. Okay, so statistical power. So one way to do this is to say, what do each of these mean before you look at the answers? That's one way to do this. So, and you might all have different ways of thinking of this, but let's look at one way. So I might draw a picture for myself just to think about this. I might draw a normal distribution in which I'm assuming the null hypothesis is true, and then next to it another normal distribution assuming the alternative is true. And I might then decide to give myself a little primer in what I think my different errors are. So if the null was true, if I'm looking at the null, and if I actually rejected because I got a value in the tail, that's referring to alpha, the probability of a type 1 error. So if I thought of alpha over 2, that's what I would have in each tail, assuming the null was true. So if alpha over 2 is the probability of a type 1 error in each tail, then I could try to remind myself what beta is. And beta, with beta, I have to switch my attention to the alternative being true. Because beta is what I'm cross-shading in the left tail under that alternative distribution, which is where I would fail to reject the null when, in fact, the null is false because the alternative is true. So beta is the probability of a type 2 error. It's the probability of rejecting, of failing to reject the null. I think I said that wrong, so I'm going to rewind. Failing to reject the null when the null is false and the alternative is actually true. And what we really want is 1 minus beta to be large, because 1 minus beta says when the alternative is true, we want to have a high probability of rejecting the null. So I've just tried to draw these to reinforce these interpretations for us. So let's say statistical power. So statistical power, this 1 minus beta, is actually the probability of rejecting the null hypothesis when the alternative, H-naught, is true. So would you all agree with me on that? And we'll see if one of these words, one of these phrases, matches it. Whereas beta by itself is going to be the probability of failing to reject the null hypothesis when the alternative is true. Let's skip down to alpha. What's alpha? When we defined it, we said it's the probability of rejecting the null when the null was actually true. And then what's 1 minus alpha? If alpha is rejecting the null when it's true, then 1 minus alpha is, it's this probability in the middle. It means you don't reject the null when the null is true. That's a good thing. It's not the error. It's a good thing. So we'd say 1 minus alpha is failing to reject the null hypothesis given the null is true. And then p-value is very different, isn't it? Because p-value depends on the data. And we said it's the probability of getting the results we observed, or something more extreme, just by chance. So I think we can do p-value pretty quickly. P-value is the probability of obtaining a sample result as extreme or more extreme than the one we observed under the assumption that the null hypothesis is true. So I'm going to match p-value with that, which in this version is C. So what if I looked at A? The probability of rejecting the null when it's actually true, that seems to be alpha, rejecting the null when it's actually true. So alpha is that. The probability of failing to reject the null when it's actually true, I think that's 1 minus alpha. The probability of rejecting the null hypothesis when the specified alternative is true, that's a good thing. That's 1 minus beta, so that's statistical power. And then the probability of failing to reject the null hypothesis when that alternative is actually true is what we would refer to as beta. Okay. So unless I hear any comments, questions, concerns, keep going. So we'll go on to 7 through 18. Okay, 7 through 18 are concerning a study of 97 elderly individuals in the Sleep Heart Health study, and the outcome of interest was a self-reported Epworth Sleepiness Scale that we've referred to as ESS by sex. Individuals, and you had seen this on a quiz, they have this variable that they rate on certain levels for 8 questions, and then the total is defined by adding these scales together. And the range will go from 0 to 24, where higher scores are more predictive of daytime sleepiness. So you're seeing in Table 1 some of the summary statistics. So by sex, when sex is 0, those are females. When sex is equal to 1, those are males. And we see the percentiles, the mean, the standard deviation given here. In number 7, it says, suppose a box and whisker plot of the ESS scores for males was constructed. Which of the following is not correct? So let's think about the box and whisker plot. So we would have Q3, which is the 75th percentile, which is 12. Q2, which is the 50th percentile, which is 8. Q1, which is the 25th percentile, which is 4. There's our box plot. part of it, the box at least. So, which is not correct? So, 50% of the ESS scores fall between 4 and 12. So, the middle 50% do. That's true. 50% of the scores fall at or above 8. That's true. 50%, 25% of the ESS scores fall at or below 4. That's true. But maybe I'll read that again. Where am I? I'm on C. 25% of the scores fall at or above 4. Don't do what I am, standing up here taking the exam, because 4 is the 25th percentile, which means 25% of them fall below 4 and 75% fall at or above 4. So this is actually false. Why is it false? Because it should have said 75% fall at or below 4, or it could have said 75% of the scores fall at or below or above 4. So that's false. 75% fall at or below 12, that's true. 50% fall at or above 8, that's also true. So the only one that was false was this one that I flubbed, right? 25% of the scores fall at or above 4. That is incorrect because it's 75% fall at or above 4. 8. The quality of sleep individuals' experience differs from day to day due to environmental and biological medical factors. What consequences of this fact is reflected in the distribution of ESS scores? So this is saying the quality of the sleep might be influenced by these other factors. So does it result in a positive bias or a negative bias? Does it have anything to do with bias? What is bias? So bias is the difference between the average and the truth in the reality. So is this going to our biologic and medical factors creating a bias? They're not creating a bias. These are false. These are reasons for why there's some variability in these ESS scores. So it's not going to decrease dispersion. It may increase dispersion. So this is false. Will this result in reflecting measurement variation or natural variation? So measurement variation, what would that be due to? So that would be errors in the measurement. That could be due to things like self-reporting, lack of memory, right? If the ESS score was measured in some quantitative way, it's actually a subjective reporting, but a measurement variation in this case would be the reporting by the individual. The biologic and the medical factors are really what is causing some natural variation in these ESS scores. So that answer was natural variation. Okay, well then we're on to number nine. So assume that the ESS score is normally distributed in the population of males. So we could assume this is a normal distribution that has some mean mu and a standard deviation sigma for males. What values of ESS scores span the middle percent of the population distribution? And then the hint here is to use the sample statistics to approximate the corresponding population parameters in your calculation. So let's first say, if we're looking at the population, what would span the middle 50%? So if we transformed this to a Z and looked in the Z table, we'd be looking at how many standard deviations above the mean would reflect the middle 50%. So you might want to just double check by going to the Z table, which I conveniently have here in microscopic fashion. So the middle 50% can correspond to having 0.25 in one tail, or we could use, if we wanted to, the D column to look at the middle 50%. So I'm going to look at 0.25 in the B column, and I'm still not there, but am I finally there? around here, about 0.67, 0.675, which corresponds to a D column that has about 0.5 in it, right? So the number of standard deviations above the mean, going back to that question, would be this span would say take mu plus 0.68, if you will, whichever one you want. And so you'll notice, we'll come back to that, but let's use 0.675 times sigma. And what would the lower range be? Mu minus 0.675 times sigma. But the question says, use the sample statistics to approximate these. So to approximate them, mu is going to be approximated by X bar, and sigma will be approximated by S. So why don't we then use X bar minus 0.67 times S as the lower range, and X bar plus 0.675 times S as the upper range, and that should give us about the middle 50% for the population distribution. The key was that this was the population distribution of X's, of ESS scores. So it was asking us to go back, look at what the mean is for males. So here's males. The mean was 7.81. The standard deviation is 4.73. So it really will be 7.82 plus or minus 0.675 times 4.73. So we can see that all of these are looking somewhat similar but somewhat different. There's one thing that you might have noticed, and nobody pointed this out until about the very end of the exam, but this should have been more appropriately 0.675. The 7 sort of got a little bit misplaced, such as invisible, but it didn't seem to bother anybody. So the question is, which one of these is correct? Well, it's the one that takes 7.81 plus or minus 0.675 times S, which was 4.73. So the answer here would have been C. What are all the rest of these referring to? So if you had looked at D in the range of plus or minus 4.73 over the square root of 43, what would that have been the answer to? That would have been the answer to what? It would have been what values of the ESS average scores, what values of the mean ESS scores, what would be the range of those from a sampling distribution of size 43? So it would have been what's the range of the X bars, not of the X's? And then these other ones, a lot of them are dealing with 22.35. What's that value? It's the variance. So that would have taken the S squared term instead of S. Okay? So this question was very much looking at the population of the X's, the ESS scores, not the X bars, which would have been the mean or the average ESS scores. Does that make sense to everybody? Make sense? I mean, you can ask a question. We had a lot of questions on number 2, and I was happy to take the questions, but I think we had answered everything on that. So I'm happy if you have a question on this one to just ask it. Just ask it now. Otherwise, we'll move on to number 10. Okay. Yes.
Why is it not the 50% confidence for number D?
Okay, so I will take that back. So let's say we were trying to come up with a new question for D. D is not the correct answer to this question. But if we were, if we said that we had X bar plus or minus the tabled T or Z value times S over the square root of N, and so we are approximating this by the Z, then we could have had a question that said, what is the, it would be the 50% confidence interval, right? The 50% confidence interval for the true population mean. And that would have taken X bar plus or minus the Z corresponding to 0.5 split into two tails on both sides of this distribution times S over the square root of N. So I will agree with you that if we had a different question that asks which of the following corresponds to the 50% confidence interval for the true population mean ESS score based on the data, then I would have gone with D. But this was talking about the middle 50% of the population distribution, the X's, so that's why we would go with C. Yep. Where the middle number is actually a mean, and sigma is the spread in the values of those ESS scores, not mean ESS scores. Go ahead.
Right. So it's a mean, but of one time of measurement, not a mean of many different.
That's right. This, when we are talking about the population distribution, we're talking about the spread of those population ESS scores. And the mean that we have here, the true population mean, is the mean of all those possible ESS scores in the population. We don't know mu, so because we don't know mu, we can't get the true middle 50% of population values, but we can approximate this range by taking X bar as an estimate of mu. It's the best we have. Based on our knowledge from the sample, our best guess at the true population mean is this value of X bar, which is 7.81. Our best guess based on the data, our best guess on the estimated standard deviation is S, which is 4.73. So 4.73 is the estimated spread in the values of the ESS score, not the mean score, the ESS score itself. So hearing nothing else, we'll go to 10. So 10 says, for this question only, so this means just for number 10, assume that the true population standard deviation of ESS scores is known to be 5. So, in fact, this is now saying, suppose you're told that the standard deviation in the population is 5 points. So, of course, we know that what that means. Approximately 68% would be within plus or minus 5 points of the mean. Approximately 95% of these scores would be within what? Plus or minus how many standard deviations of the mean? Maybe it's worth just reviewing this just a bit. In the population for the X's, if the standard deviation was known as 5, we would be able to say that within, that about 0.68 are between mu minus 5 and mu plus 5. About 95% are between mu minus 10 and mu plus 10, yes? And almost all of the observations are between mu minus 15 up to mu minus plus 15, yeah, of the population scores. So if I was to try to describe this, so if I actually took this out, whatever the mean is, almost all of them are between 3 standard deviations below the mean and 3 standard deviations above the mean. Okay, that was a side note, just as a reminder. Reminder side note. They're going to go away now. Okay, so we're told that the standard deviation is equal to 5. conduct a hypothesis test that the mean ESS in elderly men is no greater than 8 versus the alternative hypothesis that it is greater than 8. So this is saying the null hypothesis is that the real mean in the population is less than or equal to 8, and the alternative is that the mean is greater than 8. And so in order to conduct this test, we're no longer talking about the population distribution. We're talking now about the sampling distribution of the statistic, X bar, that approximates the mean. So here we no longer are using sigma by itself. We're dealing with the standard error corresponding to the statistic X bar. You all with me? So our question here is conduct a test of the null hypothesis that mean ESS is no greater than 8 versus the alternative that it is greater than 8. What's the p-value? So tell me what you know from the data. What's the sample size? 43. What was the sample mean? 7.81. What's the sample standard deviation? 4.73, right? We looked at that before. Where am I getting those from? Getting it from here, these males. 43 males, their mean is 7.81, standard deviation 4.73. So I'm just, pardon me? So let's do that, but I was sort of just saying let's look at the data. So now somebody has intervened and says for the moment, you don't have to estimate this. You're told that sigma is equal to 5, right? So we're told this. So we don't have to use S. We're told it. So that means instead of using a T, we're going to use a Z. So our test statistic is going to be based on, well, first of all, if I drew this, if I'm hypothesizing that the mean is 8 or less, this sampling distribution we're hypothesizing is centered at 8. And what was our observed statistic? 7.81. So the question is it likely that you would have gotten 7.81 if the truth was 8, or is it unlikely? That's our question. So the way your artist has drawn it is looking pretty likely, but depending on the standard deviation and the sample size, it might have been unlikely. So instead of just eyeballing it, we're going to transform this to a Z, and the way we do that is by taking X bar minus the hypothesized value divided by sigma over the square root of N, that's sigma X bar. So we have 7.81 minus the hypothesized value of 8, because equality is in that one-sided test. And then sigma, we're told, is 5, and the sample size is 43, so we're divided by the square root of 43. So that's our Z statistic. And from there, we're being asked to calculate the one-sided p-value. Yes. Right, it's not, because of the fact that we're talking about a null hypothesis about means. So our corresponding sampling distribution that allows us to test that is the sample statistic X bar, and its corresponding standard deviation or standard error depends on sigma divided by the square root of N. Right. So here, what I've drawn is the Z statistic equals X bar minus the hypothesized value over, and let me just erase this to make very clear that what is in the denominator of this Z is sigma X bar. So the correspondence is that here we have X bar in the numerator, so sigma X bar has to go in the denominator. If this had been a population question, then Z would have been based on X minus mu naught divided by sigma, because what are the sigmas? It's implied, but we don't usually put it. The sigma is the standard deviation of the x's. So that standard deviation goes along with the variability in x. Sigma x bar is the variability in the x bars. The reason that, so what we're doing is this fact that we're told that sigma is 5, that the true population sigma is 5, what it does for us, it says instead of using a T statistic, it's a Z statistic. Otherwise, if we had used S over the square root of N to estimate this, it would have been a T. Does that make sense to everybody? So being told that sigma was 5 allows us to set this up as a Z. So the mantra is unknown sigma, use a T. Right? Known sigma, use a Z. So we have a Z statistic here that we can do a little bit of math. And if you do a little bit of math, what do you get? Okay, so I'm going to make sure that we have some corroboration here. So if you were to actually get that Z statistic, this would be negative about 0.25. So it's negative 0.25. So it's out here in this tail. We're really asking, what's the probability of getting a mean of 7.81 or less? That translates into getting a Z statistic of negative 0.25. It's pretty close to zero, negative 2.25 or something less. So we'd have to look this up in the Z table. But because of symmetry, the probability of getting a Z value that's less than negative 0.25 is the same as the probability of getting a Z value that's greater than positive 0.25. Yes? Just by symmetry? You can give me a little bit more affirmative, you know, reaction. But so that will allow us to go to the Z table, which don't leave home without. So we had 0.25. It's on the first page. It looks like if you looked in at one tail, that probability is 0.4. So let's go back and see if we have a p-value that looks like that. And we do. So it looks to me like sorry, so we're doing a one-sided test. Okay. Okay, here's our statistic. It's negative 0.25. We have a one-sided test that goes in to the left, so we're looking at it being in the direction of the alternative hypothesis. So the alternative hypothesis would be looking at the probability. So we'll erase this and try this again. So we're looking at the probability of Z being greater than negative 0.25. So how would we go about doing that? We'd figure out what that tail probability, which was equal to 0.4. We already figured that out. So what would be the opposite? It would be 1 minus that, which is 0.6. So we'll go with E. So let's just review that one more time. So I was just looking in one tail. So that would have been appropriate for a two-sided test. I could have taken that one tail and multiplied by 2. But this is a one-sided test in which the alternative is to the right. So our probability is based on the probability of getting what we observed, negative 0.25, or something more extreme in the direction of the alternative distribution. Yes? Okay, so you're asking if I had framed the question in a different way, which would be the question that would be framed? Which one?
Oh,
Okay, so I think the question was this. What if you actually didn't divide by the square root of n? What would the question have been framed like? And here's what the question would have been framed like. So if indeed what we ended up getting was this. So suppose z was equal to x minus some hypothesized value of 8 over sigma, which is 5. It couldn't be x bar. It would have to have been x. So the question would have been, what's the probability that x, meaning a particular observation, is greater than 7.81? So then we would have transformed this to a z by taking 7.81 minus 8 over the standard deviation that corresponds to the x, which is 5. And then it would have been something that isn't dividing by the sample size. So the question here would have been, what's the probability of observing an ESS score of 7.81 or greater if the mean ESS score in the population is 8. And what else are we told? That the standard deviation in the population is 5. So that would have been saying we're looking at ESS scores themselves, the X's. We're hypothesizing that the mean is 8. The spread in the scores, not the mean scores, would be reflected by sigma of 5. And we're asking what's the chance that we would get an ESS score itself of 7.8 or something bigger. That would have been the question that would have gone along with this calculation. We don't, so for our inferences, we're not making probability statements about the X's. All of our inferences are based on probability statements about the statistic. And the statistics we've talked about are X bar, X1 bar minus X2 bar, P hat, P1 hat minus P2 hat. We're using a statistic to summarize, we're not talking about the actual measure itself. Okay, so we could go on to number 11. So now dichotomize ESS as low. If the ESS score is less than 14, we'll call it low, and we'll say that ESS score greater than or equal to 14 is high. And then based on the data above, is ESS independent of sex? But we've dichotomized this. We've dichotomized it. So you can think of it as saying here's males and females, here's low ESS, and here's high ESS, right? And if they were independent, then we could say the probability of having a low ESS score would be the same in males and females. The probability of having a high ESS score would be the same in males and females, right? So we have to go back to the data and see what the data tell us. So we have to go back to the data. Look at females first. So what's the probability of having a high ESS score among females? So if I asked you, what's the chance that you see a high ESS score among the group of females? Another way of saying this is, what percentage of females have high ESS scores? So I see 14 here. That defines high. And so what percentage have 14 or above? Yes, it's 10%. So this would be, 90% have 14 or below. So 10% have 14 or above. So if among females, it's only 10%. What is it among males? So here's 14. And it looks like what's the percentage of males who have high ESS scores? 10%. Is it the same? Right. So since they're the same, what does it say about ESS score and sex. They're independent. So we'll go back to the question and answer it. So would we say, yes, they're independent because the high ESS for females is the same as the probability of high ESS for males? That's true. So I'm thinking that looks like a good response. We can go on to the next one. So no, because the probability of high ESS in females is not the same as the probability of low ESS in females. That's not the definition of independence. Independence is saying the probability of being in one of these groups overall is the same as the probability of, say, being in the high group among males, as the same as the probability of being in the high ESS group among females. So it's, if they're independent, your chance of being in a high ESS group does not depend on gender. I love how you're all just staring at me right now, but that's okay. So when we talk about independence, we say there's no association. My chance of being in a high ESS group does not depend on my gender. And here we saw these probabilities were both 0.1. So that's why A is the correct answer. But to talk about independence, we're not looking at how this is articulated in B or C, and we're not looking at whether the joint, if they were independent, then the joint probability would equal the product of those two. But are we able to? We could fill out the 2x2 table and figure out whether this is true. Do you want to do that? So the answer should have been yes, because the joint probability is the product of the two. So this answer is incorrect. The answer is yes. But I'm happy to take us through why D is incorrect if you want. Do you want to go through setting up the 2x2 table or just skip it? Everybody wants to skip it. Okay. You can look in the answer key. Yes? Right. That's why I was asking if anybody wanted to. So if we set up the 2x2 table, remember that there were 43 males, wasn't that right? And how many females were there? 43 males, and there were 54 females. Okay. For a total of 97 people. Okay, now we have to figure out what are the cells for this table. So we just figured out that 10% of the females had high ESS. So on a very good day, 10% of 43 people, and I'm happy with having parts of people, so we'll say 10% is 4.3. We don't need to, you know, keep the decimal, but wouldn't you say 10%? But I put that in the wrong cell. I see that now. Yes. Okay. Are you happy you're here? Yes. Is that what you're going to point out? Good. How about 10% of 54 is 5.4? Okay. So then we do a little bit of subtraction. So it looks like we might have what? 43 minus 4.3. I'm happy to round these if you'd be happier with it. I don't think it really is going to make much of a difference. Why don't we say 10% is 4 people in the male group and 5 people here, a total of 9 overall who are in high SES. So it means among males, 39 would be in the low ESS. 43 minus 4 is 39. Out of the 54 females, if there are 5 in the high ESS, then 49 have to be low. Is that sounding pretty good? So that the total in the low ESS group have to be 39 plus 49, which is 88. The total in the high ESS, males plus females, is 9. As a double check, they add to 97. And then we can do things like this. We could say, well, is the probability of being high ESS and female, is it equal to the product? Our question is it equal to the product of having the probability of having high ESS times the probability of being female? So what's the probability of having high and being female? High and female is 5 out of 97, for those who were interested in the 2x2 table. The probability of having high ESS itself is 9 out of 97. What's the probability of being female? ¿54 over 97? And so if you do a little bit of calculation, I think you need to use a calculator to do this. Anybody have their calculator? I have my calculator. So what we should see is 9 times 54 divided by 97. I'm getting about 0.05 here. And on the other side, it's also about 0.05. So it looks like if we did do this, then we could have said yes. But the answer would have been yes, because the joint probability equals the product of the two individual probabilities. But the response in this particular exam said no, and so that made it a false statement. The other way is I had taken us through the conditional probabilities by looking at the summarization, and we knew that they were 10%. I could look at it again and say, maybe I'm not going to look at high, I could look at low. What's the probability of low ESS among males? And that would be 39 over 43, which should be about 0.9. What's the probability of low ESS among females? It's 49 over 54, which is about 0.9. So that's another way in which we would have been able to also see, since these data are in a 2x2 table, that ESS score and gender are independent. Okay. So, but the only one that was a correct response in this question was that the conditional probability of high ESS for females was the same as the conditional probability of high ES for males. Okay, on to 12. Suppose that 4 older adults were randomly selected from the total group in Table 1. What's the probability that 2 or fewer were female or had high ESS? So I'm glad we set up that 2x2 table, because it will help us for this question. But if we said here's N equals 4, and we know that individuals have the characteristic of being female or having high ESS or the converse, so this is sounding very binomial distribution-like, the probability that the number out of 4 is 2 or fewer is the question we're asking. So if we first have to say N is 4, but what's P? What's P? P is the probability of being female or having high ESS. So we have the table. It's there. Probability of being female or high. So whichever way you choose to look at this, I'll first look at, we have 54 females, and we were looking for high, right? Or high. There were 9 who have high, but we're double counting how many? 5. We're double counting 5. So that probability, that P on the next slide, is going to be 54 plus 9, minus 5 divided by 97. Does that make sense? We're taking the 54 females, the 9 high ESS, subtract the 5, we're double counting, divided by the overall total. And that probability, if anybody got it, oh no, plug in. Oh, this was a problem. Sorry. Somebody calculate that while I'm plugging in. No, nobody wants to calculate it. Okay, hopefully we're recovering here. Okay. Okay, so it looks to me that that's something like 63 minus 5, which is 58, divided by 97. And what do you get? Okay, so we'll say that's about 0.6. So that means Q is equal to 0.4. So we're able to go back to number 12 and say P is 0.6, Q is 0.4. We're interested in the probability that X is less than or equal to 2. The probability of less than or equal to 2 is you can either write that as the probability that X equals 0 plus the probability that X equals 1 plus the probability that X equals 2. Or another way to write it, since there's only 4 individuals here, is that it's the same as 1 minus the probability of 3 or 4. Yeah? 1 minus the probability that X equals 3 minus the probability that X equals 4. But I maybe did a little bit too much, because what do we actually have here already? We have it given with 0 through 2 in C. I actually did notice that some people were saying B, but if you had said B, the P and Q values were not correct. Say that again, please. Right. So if you had chosen B, remember we had actually looked at before the conditional probabilities of having high ESS and being female would have been 0.05. But do you remember the conditional probabilities, meaning the 10% of females had high ESS? I would have said the answer to B would have had to have been not female or had high. It would have been among females, the probability of having high ESS, in order for that to be P. So it was the wrong P and Q in answer B. Okay, we're moving along here. Now we're at 13. We want to take a break? You want to just, like, move, stand up, shake? Okay, you can move. Suppose that all possible samples of size 54 could be taken for females aged 85 or greater. Again, define high as 14 or greater. Assuming that the population proportion with high is 0.1, what's the probability of obtaining a sample proportion of high scores equal to 0.05 or larger? So the wording here has now said that we're talking about population proportions, meaning P's, with high. We're actually told to assume that the population proportion is 0.1. So that's what we're told in this third line. And we're asked a question here, what's the probability of obtaining a sample proportion, that's P hat, what's the probability of getting a P hat that's equal to 0.05 or larger? So here's what we need to solve. What's the probability that we would get a sample proportion of 0.05 or larger? Assuming that P equals 0.1. So if we assume that P is 0.1, what can we assume about Q? That Q is 0.9. So here is where we'd say, how do we transform this to a Z? So again, I'm going to just remind everybody that the formula sheets are there to help you in studying. So here, in fact, is the Z for proportions. So we know that we are assuming P naught is 0.1, P naught is 0.1, Q naught is 0.9. So we'll go back and hopefully go through this pretty quickly. So how do we transform it? We can write this as the probability of Z being greater than P hat minus P naught all over the square root of P naught Q naught over N. So what's P hat? We're asked, what's the probability of P hat being greater than or equal to 0.5? What are we assuming P to be? 0.1. So our standard error of P hat is going to be the square root of 0.1 times 0.9 over the sample size of 54. And this should reduce to the probability that Z is greater than. So we can say, is this going to be a negative or a positive value? negative. And it ends up being negative 1.22. We could go ahead and calculate the probability as well, but the answer just had you stop at the transformation to a Z. Yeah.